I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ethan Chorin spoke with the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, by phone a few hours before the consulate in Benghazi was attacked and the ambassador and three members of his security detail were killed. Chorin was in Benghazi at the time working on plans for a medical training facility for eastern Libya. He had first been stationed in that country from 2004 to 2006 when the U.S. reestablished diplomatic ties with Libya. Chorin has been back a number of times since then, advised the 2008 Obama campaign on foreign policy, and co-founded the Avicenna Group last year working on developing Libya's capacity to deal with trauma. He's also the author of a brand new book called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Ethan Chorin, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let me go back to that night of September 11th when you were on the phone with Ambassador Stevens. What were you two talking about?
As you mentioned in the intro, I had been spending the last year with a Libyan-American colleague trying to facilitate a partnership between two teaching hospitals in the U.S. and the largest tertiary care facility in Benghazi, a 1,200-bed hospital. And I had learned that Ambassador Stevens was in Benghazi at the time, and I wrote him an email, and he responded quickly and said that, in fact, he would be very enthusiastic and felt to come and witness a preliminary signing of an agreement around this project.
Did he in any way mention growing either protests outside of the consulate or concerns about his safety?
No, not at all. I mean, we had a series of email exchanges in the afternoon, and there was no indication when I talked to him that there was anything amiss. That was about 7:40 in the evening. In fact, he sounded very cheerful and at ease.
In fact, you called back shortly after that, or I guess when the attacks had begun, and you were able to actually hear on your phone what was happening at the consulate in Benghazi, which must have been terrifying. What did you hear?
Well, the first conversation was with one of his security detail regarding plans, security arrangements for the visit to the hospital the next morning. Again, that was about half an hour after the original conversation with Ambassador Stevens. No indications of anything wrong then. That was around 8:15 or so. Reported back to the director of the hospital that things were on for the next day, and he made a comment that, had I heard anything amiss, that something that they had heard that something was going on at the compound, U.S. compound. I said, no, I hadn't, and I called the called the security contact back to see if what was going on, and the response was very alarming.
In what way?
We've got a major situation here.
Indeed.
With a few expletives inserted.
And could you hear things in the background?
I couldn't hear things in the background then, no. We all went back up to our rooms at the Tibesti Hotel, which is the main hotel for foreigners in Benghazi. And a few minutes later, we heard the first of what sounded like it was a barrage, RPG, I imagine an RPG barrage, followed throughout the night by bursts of gunfire and some very bizarre activity outside the hotel.
What do you think, from your perspective and your knowledge of Libya, the death of Ambassador Stevens, what does it mean for the Libyan people?
Well, I mean, it's a great tragedy. It's one of the markers of the unfortunate markers of this process that began with the revolution last in February of 2011. As awful as those events are, my hope to some degree is that this will serve as a catalyst for some necessary action in terms of the nascent government trying to coalesce, secure, take care of the security situation. There may be a parallel with the death of the assassination of the Benghazi military commander, the NTC, National Transitional Council commander, back in late July of 2011, which was seen at the time to be a tremendous disaster, but then turned into a kind of a cover for the government at the time to consolidate control over various militias and in fact, move on to take Tripoli. So there's chance that you know, pressure resulting from this incident will result in something positive. Of course, you know, it also could result in a greater loss of confidence in Libya's security situation, which, you know, could have further unraveling effects. So, but we'll have to see.
And in this country, there's been a lot of finger-pointing about who knew what when. Was this a terrorist attack? Was it an angry crowd protesting a video that insulted the prophet? Is this a helpful debate to have in this country, do you think?
Well, it's the problem is that there's so many different accounts of what happened. I don't see that it's particularly productive. It's been a tremendous, this event has become tremendously politicized. Lots of misrepresentation of facts or lack of facts, I imagine that after the election cycle is over, we'll find out a lot more.
You wrote in a piece in the New York Times just a couple of days after this attack in Benghazi. You wrote, Libya continues to be a sideshow of the broader Arab Spring. And it's interesting those words that you use, because this is, of course, after a NATO operation, support for rebels, the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, the support or at least tacit support for this new government. Why do you think Libya has or continues to be a sideshow?
Well, actually, one of the sort of themes of the book is the notion that Libya has always been treated as something of a sideshow, an accessory to a larger problem. Whether it was, you know, back in the during the Eisenhower years of the Eisenhower Doctrine in the 60s, 50s, to roll back the Soviet Union, the issues over oil pricing, terrorism. You know, Libya's had actually, when you look at it, a fairly large impact on U.S. interests in the region. And the whole debate over prior to the intervention in Libya about whether Libya constituted a fundamental interest or not, I think we've seen that, in fact, it has.
Indeed.
And I believe that it has had it was so important, in fact, because this was in the context of the 2009 New Beginning speech that President Obama delivered in Cairo, in which he expressed solidarity with the Arab street against tyranny. You know, this created certain expectations, and when the Arab Spring broke out, there were very few places in which the United States and the West in general could intervene without provoking a whole range of other consequences, which were the risks of which were far greater. So this was almost there was a lot of debate about what was people for and against the intervention, and it was the process of figuring out what to do appeared to be quite chaotic. But in the end, I think the right decision was made, and in retrospect, I would think that that decision would be validated. The question now is what happens now. Do you
Indeed.
You know is the attack in Benghazi the result of a kind of a deflection of support when you've won the first stage of the battle, so to speak?
Is there any way to gauge how much support there is in Libya for the United States?
Well, yes, I think there's a tremendous amount of support in Libya for the United States. It's not, and it's quite measurable. When I was serving in Tripoli for 2 years, from 2004 to 2006, I encountered just across the board. I mean, the people that I was speaking to, I was acting in a commercial economic capacity as a as part of the future embassy there. Everyone wanted to talk about trade. There was a sort of the older people remembered their model of business and the way the world works was founded on was connected with how they envisioned what they remembered from the United States back in the 60s. It's a model of democracy, of opportunity, etc. The youth are very much attracted by American culture. We brought a band into the Tripoli International Fair in 2005, and there's a crowd of 10,000 perhaps more Libyans waving American flags. And we commented to ourselves, where else in the Middle East are you going to find such a such a scene? There was no press there to cover it.
Which tells you something.
Yes. Also, that tells you something, presumably, as well, that, you know, Libya was still sort of seen as sort of a fringe element, which comes, you know, with the whole shtick, so to speak, of you know, Gaddafi and his larger-than-life antics, which, you know, which was also a political tool that he used very, very adeptly.
Well, picking up on Muammar Gaddafi and obviously was running the country when you were there from 2004 to 2006, how should we think about him as we look back at his years running Libya?
Well, you know, it was a deceptively, you know, I think when I arrived in 2004, 2005, and you know, as other Westerners and Western representatives of Western companies came in, I think the aura of the place was one of it being rather benign. That, you know, Gaddafi was this sort of a humorous individual who really couldn't be taken that seriously. I think that's a very flawed way of looking at things. He was an extraordinarily shrewd person, but he also had you know, a series of complexes, if you want to put it that way, which made dealing with him extraordinarily difficult and confused pretty much everyone who, you know, both within the country and outside of it. And you know, he was very skilled at maintaining these competing power bases in this constant state of confusion. And one of the major arguments of the book is that, in fact, with the Lockerbie bombing and the resulting 10-year, you know, close to what, eight years of international sanctions, followed by the rapprochement, was actually adding more balls to his confusing game, which he couldn't control. That the rapprochement, the agreement with the West, was actually something of a Trojan horse, and ultimately led to the basically the weakening of his regime.
In fact, we're almost up in a break here. You say much of what happened to Libya is the result of negligence on the part of Libya's leadership and the international community, particularly the U.S. and Europe, which paid attention to what was happening in the country only when it was politically and economically expedient.
Yes, I agree.
You agree with your own
statement,
words.
But
it is.
I agree with that. I think effectively the United States was at the time the Bush administration was passionately looking after opportunities to crack down on the war against terror was the name of the game. And if you know, we could get a non-proliferation success and claiming that Libya was giving up its chemical and nuclear weapons program, this would be a great boon, and also provide a countering success story to what was going on in Iraq right now. The situation was getting much worse.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our guest, Ethan Choren, author of a new book called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
When Artie Goldstein pictured the person his daughter Jill would marry, a woman was not who he had in mind. But he came to not only accept it, but to want to share his story, which is how he came to star in an Expedia ad and become a YouTube sensation.
As a parent, you want to support your children.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. Longwood Gardens and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society present a lecture and book signing with international landscape architect Kim Wilkie on October 29th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Wilkie's the author of a new book, Led by the Land, where he discusses landscape, sustainability, regeneration, and design. Wilkie's also the designer of Longwood Gardens' East Conservatory Plaza, home to the largest green wall in North America. Tickets and details at longwoodgardens.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ethan Chorin. He was stationed in Libya from 2004 to 2006 when the U.S. reestablished diplomatic ties with that country. He has been back a number of times since then, has been working on Libya's capacity to deal with trauma, co-founded the Avicenna Group last year to deal with that particular issue. He's also the author of a brand new book called Exit the Colonel. That would be Colonel Gaddafi, the hidden history of the Libyan Revolution. Any questions or comments? Talking about, of course, a very important and I think oftentimes hard to understand country. We are talking about Libya, and the phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ethan, let me go back to 2004, and you were sent to Libya at that point to essentially help reestablish diplomatic ties between that country and Libya. Sanctions had been lifted a couple of years earlier. The idea that that Gaddafi was being sort of folded back into the world community. What was it like to establish a mission in Libya at the time?
Well, I have to say, this is my first tour in the Foreign Service, which is a bit unusual. So I can't claim to have led that effort. I was the economic commercial attaché at that point. My job was to essentially go out into the community, meet people, talk about trade. Trade and economic opening was the sort of the lever for the process at that time. And politics was definitely still and would remain for some time off the table, but people would use economic conversations to deliver not subtle and not so subtle messages about what they hoped for Libya's political future.
In fact, they would pull you aside and share some of their concerns about this real Gaddafi.
Yeah, this was something that made a tremendous impact on me, and in fact, I think motivated me once the revolution broke out to come back and try to help in some way. I had people from all walks of life, from taxi drivers to former parliamentarians to people who stood to profit a great deal from the opening, saying, "Look, the U.S. has a moment here to pressure the regime to make certain reforms, and if you proceed, particularly with things like removing Libya from the terror list, etc., without exacting the cost that you want, instability will follow. The reform effort will ultimately fail." This is, essentially what happened.
Well, in fact, you say that the lifting of the sanctions allowed Gaddafi and others, but certainly allowed Gaddafi to amass enormous amounts of wealth. And this is a country, of course, that has oil.
Sure. Libya is the largest oil producer and has the largest reserves in Africa, 78 billion barrels at the moment, and is still incompletely surveyed. There's a tremendous amount of wealth there. The problem in Libya, from the U.S. oil perspective, is that the conditions for doing business were so complex that oftentimes it wasn't quite worth it.
But going back to that quote, though, do you think that the fact that Libya had oil, to use your own words, made it expedient for the U.S. and for Europe to look the other way when it came to his brutality?
Well, I also argue that the oil was definitely an issue in Libya. Clearly, if Libya was still an extraordinarily poor country, the degree of interest would be far less. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
Sure. As we know from countries that are rich in oil, that, to use a pretty ridiculous word here, but that does complicate the U.S. and relationship with a country because we are so dependent on oil.
Sure. I mean, my point, I guess, was that in terms of the rationale for the rapprochement, I do not believe that oil was the primary motivator, and most people would assume it is. But in fact, what was going on was that there was an evolving disaster in Iraq, and the administration needed a success story in converting a rogue regime. And this was a very, you know, Gaddafi had been suing for peace essentially for several years at that point. So the whole narrative about Gaddafi being so terrified, and he may have been scared, you know, scared, but the idea that he was shocked by the image of Saddam Hussein being pulled out of a spider hole into coming forward and offering up his weapons of mass destruction, such as they were, is, I think, you know, a bit of fiction.
But are you saying it was a false conversion on Gaddafi's part? Was he playing the West?
Yes, of course he was playing the West.
That's what he did, right?
He did it extraordinarily well. And part of back to the negligence comment, I think the one major issue about the way the United States dealt with Libya was that there were all of these agreements that were not put in writing per se. There was no enforcement mechanism. If you look at the Lockerbie negotiations around the Lockerbie payments, for example, this was an agreement that was set up between the family lawyers on behalf of the Lockerbie victims' families and the Libyan government. The United States government was not a party to that agreement, yet the agreement specifically stated that certain sums of money would be paid upon the completion of diplomatic milestones. Mm. So Gaddafi very cleverly turned his most ardent opponents, they still remained his ardent opponents, into a pressure group for certain things to happen. And everything after the opening, Gaddafi's mindset was to try to link everything to everything else. So there was a scandal, the Bulgarian nurses scandal, for example, where there was 360-odd infants that had been infected with HIV in a Benghazi hospital. Gaddafi blamed the U.S. and other nefarious elements for doing this, and tried to exact in a complicated series of financial maneuvers a countervailing compensation, which was notionally linked to the amount of money that was paid to the victims of Lockerbie. So it was constantly an attempt to sort of redeem himself or excuse or and manipulate.
But, he's often parodied as a kind of Sacha Baron Cohen type dictator. But from what you're describing is that while from the outside that might look weird and bizarre, Gaddafi had his own reasons for doing, for instance, this Bulgarian nurses story as a way of deflecting attention.
Yes, but the problem is that there's so many playing fields on which these activities were going on that I think he not only confused the outside parties, but he ultimately confused himself.
Really? I mean, confused himself because he sort of created this alternate reality for himself?
Well, yes, he was creating an alternate reality which was not did not allow him to perceive what was really going on the outside. For example, an exit that did not result in, when the revolution came, in his own death. I mean, I do think while that would have been quite complicated, there were potentially outs, and he did not take them. His own, and I think some of his, the logic is an internal logic, which, is very difficult for anyone trying to negotiate with him to understand. And that certainly made constructing policy all the more difficult.
Let me just reintroduce you, and that's Ethan Chorin, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about Libya. He was first stationed there back in 2004 when the U.S. reestablished diplomatic ties with Libya. He was there for a couple of years working on economic and commercial projects and issues, and he's been back a number of times since that time, and he's also the author of a new book called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. And again, any questions or comments you might have as we talk about Libyan history, but also the U.S. and the West relationship with this country, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to get to the revolution, but I also want to spend a moment or two talking about something else that you write in this book, which is that the U.S. used Libya as a place for rendition. Can you expand on that?
Well, actually, the rendition program is run by the CIA. Was originally, as I understand it, designed as a means of ultimately bringing Osama bin Laden to justice. And this was a program that was rediscovered, after post 9/11, and used to bring a number of individuals to. Guantanamo, for example, for interrogation. And there was an active exchange program, so to speak, with Tunisia, Egypt, and also Libya, where these countries would effectively, and this comes straight from former administration officials and intelligence people, there was this rendition program in place, and some of their concerns, as expressed to me in interviews, were that, in fact, Gaddafi was essentially drawing up lists of people that were his arch enemies and having us deliver those. Mm.
And the idea that these people were being not just interrogated but tortured?
Well, I mean, the details, certainly there are many testimonials from several of these individuals who became ultimately popular figures or known figures in the Libyan Revolution, complaining and detailing at some length what had happened to them. Some of them say they forgive the United States and we're now on the same side, but others say that they don't and that we're not.
Where would you mark the beginning of the Libyan Revolution?
Well, I think the beginning of the Libyan Revolution probably was set in the early years of Gaddafi's coming to power. He had a number of rather kooky ideas, if you want to put it that way, which at first I think struck the Libyan population as sort of interesting, along the lines of sort of the Nasser's Egypt's much beloved Nasser, pan-Arabism, mixture of pan-Arabism, socialism, and other elements. But he gradually got rid of the technocrats who were in charge, among other things, of managing Libya's oil wealth, and his policies became increasingly erratic. Mm. I would say that in the book, I mark the key pivot points as being Lockerbie, in the sense that that plunged Libya into a period of self, of darkness for several years, in which it was essentially Gaddafi was hermetically sealed into the country with an increasingly virulent Islamist opposition, which made several attempts on his life, and I think ultimately was one of the major pressures motivating him to seek rapprochement with the West. And then the actual rapprochement process itself, I think, created this framework for reform, which itself created networks that were extraordinarily useful in a class. When the Arab Spring broke out, there was these sort of Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi's reformist son, basically for several years was participating in programs that gave increasing rights of speech to groups that had been oppressed, whether it was victims of massacres, etc. There were a couple of notable ones, and these people talk to each other. And if you look at the result of that was a greater understanding on the part of the Libyans of what was going on outside the country, as well as greater cohesion between people who could potentially form a leadership cadre once the revolution began.
And this was one of Gaddafi's own sons who was a reformist.
Well, he certainly styled himself as a reformist, and I think he was fashioned as a reformist. He really was very much different than the other sons in terms of his interests and the degree of activity in politics, as opposed to creating a kind of a mafia style commercial empire. I mean, Saif al-Islam had a bit of a different formation, put it that way. What exactly he believed and how far he certainly. He was basically he couldn't go beyond a certain point because his father clearly would not brook any political reform. Whether how what he felt about that, I include in the book several interviews with people who claim one side or the other. I don't make any assumption, firm decision on that because I can't, I'm not inhabiting his universe.
Indeed. How much do you think President Obama's speech in Cairo inspired or partially inspired the revolution in Libya?
Well, I'm not sure it inspired the revolution. I think it inspired expectations of what the United States would do to help after it began. A number of very senior people in the soon-to-become transitional government felt that at the time that Libya would not see the convulsions that Egypt and Tunisia would. But once the revolution began, there was sort of an expectation that, okay, the United States has said that it's going to stand with the people, so put your money where your forces, et cetera, and your money where your mouth is.
You've been back to Libya a number of times, and most recently around September 11th. You were there in the summer as well. I mean, what does Libya look like, or what does Benghazi look like, especially after the bombing campaigns?
The bombing campaigning. Benghazi was relatively untouched. Essentially, there was a multiple tens of miles long convoy, you know, hurtling at Benghazi in mid March, which was effectively destroyed by the Allied forces. Benghazi itself suffered. You know, bombed out burned out buildings where they were, you know, near the Meydan al-Shajara, the tree square, one of the major locations of protest during that period. The Katiba, which was the so-called fist of Gaddafi, which was a kind of a base within a standing army within Benghazi, was completely destroyed. And there's lots of heroic stories around that. I mean, it's quite amazing. And all of these places have become sort of memorials to the revolution, but the place actually looks a heck of a lot better than it did back in 2005. I can tell you the civic pride is quite astounding. The security check. Then you also have to separate out Benghazi from Tripoli, from Misrata. I mean, each of these places has its own trajectory and within the revolution and suffered varying degrees of damage. I mean, Misrata was essentially, you know, large parts of it were decimated. Tripoli did not suffer that much, but and neither did Benghazi physically.
You had a piece, I'm sorry to jump in here, you had a piece in Foreign Policy in August, and I just wanted to read the very first sentence. Traveling to and from Benghazi is a bit like reading a graphic novel or a postmodern comic book, with the shifting emotions of the residents of the Libyan rebels' de facto capital plastered in billboards and splashed across graffiti-covered walls. I mean, it seems like a city that's full of graffiti and messages that people are sending out.
Oh, yes. It was quite amazing. I mean, you could almost tell by the placement and sophistication of the drawings when they were done. And it really is like reading a postmodern comic book. And the graffiti, some of it is just absolutely astoundingly, good in the sense that it's, you know, there's some really talented graffiti artists in Benghazi.
And do you see a mix? We're almost up on a break here, but do you see a mix of political messages there, a mix of messages?
The messages were, you know, overwhelmingly at that time uniform. This was written just after the assassination of Abdel Fattah Yunus. I mean, the no to tribalism, yes to unity. We're all Libyans. You know, they're all the messages that everyone wanted to hear. There was very little. You know, there was some anti-Israeli graffiti here and there, but and some pro and anti Qatar messages, but no.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Ethan Chorin today on Radio Times about Libya. He's written a new book just out called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution. We're talking about some of that history, talking about the current events as well, and what the U.S. Should and shouldn't do. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Borgata supports WHYY and presents Grammy Award winner Diana Krall in the Event Center at Borgata Hotel, Casino, and Spa in Atlantic City on Saturday, April 13th. Tickets at 1-866-900-4849 or at theborgata.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Tom Wolfe. His new novel, Back to Blood, is set in Miami. Also, part two of my recent interview with Stephen Colbert. Since he loves music and loves to sing, for this part, we asked him to bring a few tracks of music that mean a lot to him and tell us why. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll get the view of the American election from the Arab world. What were the tweets, the headlines, and why is the coverage of this election different from others? Also, Tony Wheeler, the ultimate globetrotter, the founder of the Lonely Planet Travel Guides. He'll make a stopover with us. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY, an affiliate of the Penn Cancer Network. They offer access to complex treatment options, clinical trials, a multidisciplinary team approach to care, and helpful nurse navigators. ChesterCountyHospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ethan Chorin, who really has a pretty unique knowledge of Libya. He was stationed in that country from 2004 to 2006. Actually spoke to the U.S. ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, before he was killed on September 11th. Our guest, Ethan Chorin, has been back to Libya a number of times, co-founded the Avicenna Group last year, working on developing Libya's capacity to deal with trauma. And, of course, Libya very much in the news, came up, although not much talked about, on the debate on Tuesday. And if you have any questions or comments, if you've ever wondered about Libya, this is the time to call and this is the person to talk to. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Ethan Chorin, just we've been talking a lot about the history of Libya and Gaddafi himself, but I am interested in what you think the U.S. should do next. And, of course, this is about a month or so after the ambassador was killed in Benghazi. What would you advise the Obama administration or a future Romney administration?
Well, I mean, I wrote an op-ed in which recently in the New York Times, in which I said that effectively, you know, now's not the time to retreat from Libya or to throw up one's hands and say that this is an Islamist takeover, radical Islamist takeover is inevitable. It's far from inevitable. One thing that is Libya has always sort of suffered from under Gaddafi and after is the fact that it is a very rich country in terms of how much money it's bringing in, but its capacity to, and particularly now, to put that money to work is very weak. And, you know, given the current budget issues in the United States and Congress's wariness to commit funds, it's, you know, Libya falls into a different category. And I've been trying to add up the numbers of, you know, aid and technical assistance that are going to Tunisia, for example, and to Egypt. And, you know, Libya appears to be suffering in that regard, not only from the you know, outside standpoint of outside technical assistance, but also the ability of the Libyans to articulate what it is that they actually need and want, which is a big issue. I mean, you can't force people to take something. And there's a lot of complaints back and forth, but the it's going to take some time for these structures to be to develop. There's been a lot of success. I have to say that, you know, in looking at the trajectory of Libya over the last several months, and indeed since the revolution, you know, where else have you seen a series of succession of transfers of power and violent violence-free elections than you have in Libya? Of course, there's a lot of other chaos, but. You know, Mustafa Abdul-Jalil, the head of the National Transitional Council, went, you know, at the end of his period, went back, retired to his hometown of El Beida. Mahmoud Jibril, you know, left the executive office when he said he would in October. These are great things. Technical assistance, making sure that that American organizations, from the American perspective, that they have the support that they need to offer useful services. You know, There's a lot to do.
And I'm going to quote you again. You say, and this is your New York Times piece, nevertheless, the Libyan people need support to consolidate gains and to continue to fight against largely foreign finance radicals who wish to hijack the revolution in the name of intolerance. And just how organized or even how powerful do you think these foreign finance radicals are?
Well, the radical elements are a distinct minority here, but they're powerful. They do have support from the Gulf region. There's a lot of money out there, varying estimates between $100 and $700 billion in unaccounted for former regime funds. There are reports of various people being with anti-loyalist affiliations within Libya being assassinated. One can't rule out, and certainly it's very possible that some of that money is being commingled with these groups that want to undermine the peaceful transition.
I'm quoting from the Associated Press today, Wadi Dinar, Libya. New fighting flared in a hilltop town in Libya on Tuesday between fighters defending Bani Walid, a stronghold of slain dictator Muammar Gaddafi's regime, and pro-government militias trying to win control. What's the significance of this? Or is this happening in different parts of Libya?
Well, there are a number of hotspots in Libya at the moment, and that's probably one of the more worrisome ones. I mean, if you look at Libya as a whole, it's a vast country, and some of the conflicts in the south around desert towns like Kufra, between the Toubou and the Zouai tribes, are important in the longer run, but not quite as important as the Bani Walid Misrata conflict, which again crosses that gets into the tribal. Loyalist rebel mixture, and the danger, of course, is that conflict will spill over into other areas. It's concerning, certainly, and it's a mark of the degree of importance of getting the country secured.
We hear reports that Libya is awash with guns, awash with weapons, maybe, as a result of the fact that Muammar Gaddafi amassed so many weapons. Is that a fair description?
Oh, yes. Libya is,
everyone has a gun?
Everyone has multiple guns.
Multiple guns.
It's and that's another interesting thing. Is that I remember one of the first trips we made to Benghazi, one of our interlocutors there was saying, "Well, look, if L.A. or New York had as many guns as we had in Benghazi, you'd have a much worse situation than you have in Libya right then, and that the crime rate for a while had gone down to a much lower level than it had been under Gaddafi. Of course, that's been changing a bit.
But the idea that knowing that everyone is armed, you're not going to break the law, so to speak.
Well, also here's also the regional differences. Tripoli has become a grand central station for every militia in the country that wants to exact some sort of political price for disbanding or wants something from the central government. Benghazi is still, despite its criticality, something at the periphery, and it's a much smaller, homogenous population. Everybody knows each other, so it's hard to something happens there, people know basically who did it.
When you were first stationed there in 2004, were you concerned about security or even your own security?
When I was first stationed there?
Yes.
In Tripoli, yes, we were concerned. This was more of a, and this is part of, some of my recent comments on the attack in Benghazi this past September 11th. There is, I think in the U.S. government bureaucracy structure, everything follows a hierarchy, and embassies are extraordinarily well protected. When you get into sort of situations where the post is not regularized, it's not we were in a liaison office. The compound in Benghazi was not a consulate officially; it was sort of an outpost. That's where the risks become greater, because there's not really the process of assigning resources is in flux. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's an unusual situation. I mean, you have to say that the diplomatic security has done a tremendous job protecting U.S. Diplomats in general over the last, since the for many, many years. Just very few U.S. diplomats have been killed in the course of duty. But the State Department is being asked to cover more and more locations with fewer and fewer resources, and the people who are making the decisions about what resources are needed in a given place, there's some disconnect between that and what and the assessments of the people on the ground. And I think it's not a Romney-Obama issue. It's a long-standing bureaucratic issue that goes back to certainly was no better and probably quite a bit worse under the Bush administration.
I can understand a walled compound certainly would protect personnel, but it does prevent contact with the people. I mean, the people that you're supposed to be getting to know.
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, first of all, Ambassador Stevens was extraordinarily well known for going out into the community and meeting with people and pressing the flesh, and I think that's absolutely in his various roles from the time that he arrived as Deputy Chief of Mission in 2007. You need to be able to get out and talk to people. You also need to be able to feel that you are protected in the place that you spend the most time and are stationary, your residence and the compound. Whether it's the embassy or consulate or what have you, so there's a balance there. But I don't think that that's an unresolvable conflict.
When you're in Libya, do you use security? Do you take precautions?
I should say at this point, I should say yes.
You should say yes, but I'm curious whether you do.
We certainly take precautions in terms of not traveling in large groups and keeping a reasonably low profile. The people that are hosting us have been looking out for our own safety. But any Westerners in places like this are going to be exposed. And we knew the risks that were going in when we went in there. I was particularly, I have to say, I'd made two trips one with and one without my colleague, co-founder of Avicenna, in the months before, and I didn't feel nearly as there wasn't this foreboding that I felt just before this last trip. Mm-hmm. We went because this was sort of the final stage in a long, complicated process that would result in some tangible services. So,
I'm interested in those services. I'm interested in you've chosen to work on medical facilities, particularly dealing with trauma. I'm sure there's a great need there. What is your interest in that?
Well, before, when the Libyan revolution broke out, I was working in Dubai as a head of a corporate social responsibility program for a large Dubai multinational, and the focus was clinics, primary care clinics in various countries in Africa. And that was actually a program that was originally seeded by and founded by USAID, United States Development Agency. And I thought that there might be an application in Libya with a focus on attending to war wounded and people with suffering from psychological trauma. And my partner has had quite a bit of experience in terms of managing such facilities in the States and elsewhere. And it was a nice partnership. So that's where we started out from the standpoint of trauma. We soon became, as we got to know the environment in Benghazi, we began to understand the needs a bit better and found that there was really a strong desire for training across the board and that we could play a much more effective role by serving as a catalyst between U.S.-based medical, both research institutions, teaching hospitals, et cetera, to help the Libyans essentially train up to manage the current crisis and deal with healthcare problems in the future. So we're also doing some work in diabetes, for example, outreach. That's a huge essentially health epidemic in Libya
I didn't know that. So that project is going forward, or those projects are going forward.
The recent events have put a serious, crimp in the appetites of U.S.-based partners to commit unconditionally to, what's the situation going to be like in 6 months. Some of the training has migrated to the States, so that part will presumably and hopefully go forward. And we're also, there's a lot of information that can be provided by groups in the States to help, even consultations by U.S. medical experts. So we're doing a lot of work in trying to facilitate those connections. That can be done remotely in the near term.
Let me ask you about the death of Muammar Gaddafi. Human Rights Watch has said that his death was a war crime. How do you see his death?
Well, certainly, I think it could have been avoided by himself and many of the people close to him if there was a more of an appetite to approach the whole revolution in a different way. The question of whether the NATO forces overstepped the bounds of their responsibility to protect a mandate from the UN, I think that's a mm-hmm. sort of an open issue. I think there, part of that report specified the 60-odd persons that they killed in his convoy. Now that knew, actually, I'd heard about that, in I think the week after that happened. So I'm not quite sure why that took so long to come out, but clearly that's an atrocity. I mean, and one. You have to say, look at the circumstances as well. The people, the militia that was basically in charge of that operation was made up mainly of fighters from Misrata, which had been absolutely pummeled mm-hmm. beyond recognition for weeks and more. So there was a presumably high resentment and anger there. That doesn't excuse it, of course, but. Makes it's somewhat understandable under the circumstances.
We're nearly out of time here, but as you looked over to the next decade of Libya, what do you see?
Well, I'm generally, along with some other of my colleagues in this field, cautiously optimistic. I think you must look at these processes from a much higher altitude and say, notice what's happening that's good, and try to intervene in a way that is helpful. It's ultimately up to the Libyan people. But again, if you look back at the course of Libyan history, there have been many periods of chaotic transfers of power, devolution to regional control. All of the things that we're seeing now are not in them. With the exception of the radicalization, it's things that we've seen before.
Well, on that note, Ethan Chorin, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Exit the Colonel, The Hidden History of the Libyan Revolution, just out this week. And our guest, Ethan Chorin, co-founded the Avicenna Group last year, working on developing Libya's capacity to deal with trauma. And he was stationed there from 2004 to 2006 when the U.S. reestablished diplomatic ties with Libya. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program and many of the features on our social media. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Time. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back.